Hello and welcome to episode 294 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Julia Bennis and Paul Keaveney.
So Matt, what have you been up to this week? Anything exciting to tell us about?
Well, it feels like it's been an age since I was last talking to anybody involved in the WB40 world. The last week has been the end of the school holidays, the return of eldest son from the delights of a scout camp in the Netherlands, the cleaning process that was required after that for both child and kit. Delightful. Yeah. Oh. And then just, yeah, it's been weird actually, because having spent, as dear listener, you will have probably heard me moaning about all year so far, doing pitches and things. I actually have a piece of new client work starting. The team comes together for the first time on Thursday. So I've gone from like writing pitches and presentations and all of that to actually, oh God, we've got to actually do some work now. So I've just basically been getting my head around that, which is after sort of four
nice
months.
Nice problem to have, well, I suppose.
It is, but it's also, it's kind of quite a shift as well, because you go from the kind of conceptual and the weird of selling to the conceptual and the weird of starting up a new piece of work with a client, which is, you know, different levels of weird. But so yeah, that's been kind of been the main things in my mind over the last week, month even, and enjoying it.
So good. And then with Easter in the middle, it seems like everything's just kind of stretched out and taken longer than ever.
Yeah, there's that kind of that natural slowing down of everything. I think one of the coffees I had last year was with somebody who I can't remember the exact number, but he said something like there's like 76 working days in the year, because it's basically from New Year through to about Easter, and that's the only point in the year where everybody's, because the weather's crap, so nobody goes on holiday, and so da da da. Obviously excluding the half term where rich people go skiing, but there's this, that period, and then from that point onwards for the rest of the year, as the weather gets better and all the rest of it, that's it, you're done for. That trying to find a time when everybody can be in the same room at the same time, not a chance. So yes, I think there's quite a lot in that, thinking back on it. How's your week been, Julia?
Well, I am still in my challenge of trying to persuade teams to make space to talk about and assess and address their levels of psychological safety, which has been interesting, actually. So month one was February. And because it was something new and fun and interesting, loads of people were up for doing it. But what I got was loads of teams rating themselves 8 out of 8. And that was all very jolly and lovely. But obviously, those teams are not where the value in having conversations lies. So I did a bit of a marketing push to encourage teams with lower levels of psychological safety to have these conversations. And it has worked, actually. We had a couple in March that came out with scores across the entire range of 1 to 8, which means now, obviously, I need to improve. So that's really interesting, actually. I have learned quite a lot. And the value is in a team wanting to do something about it. It's not in me telling them what to do, creating the space and giving them the permission to help themselves. Yeah. And so I felt quite lucky to observe that happening, actually.
Oh, that's good. I think, yeah, you telling them would not be psychologically safe, quite frankly, would it? Just, you know, no. I'm sure you could scare them if you wanted to, but
I probably have inadvertently.
Well,
actually,
almost.
I'm
certainly
trying to avoid that. Yeah.
But there's a couple of things that I thought about on this. I saw some of the data that you were talking about there earlier today when you gave a short talk about it to me and some colleagues, and one thing was that it was quite heavily biased towards the eights, and then there was one or two down at the other end. And one thing I've learned from bitter experience over the years is always dig into those ones and check whether they really meant it or whether they just got confused about the polarity of the Likert scale. Because I've been caught out on that so many times, and like massive fire drills for, why did this person say it was awful? And then you dig into it and you look at their verbatim feedback and you go, they said it was awful because they thought they were saying it was brilliant and they just got the wrong end.
That is such a good tip, actually. And you have given me that tip before, and I've forgotten. So I'm going to go and revisit those numbers.
Double check. The other thing, though, is I took the car in for a service last week, and something I posted on my surrogate Twitter, LinkedIn, was there was this printed, obviously professionally printed by head office, little standee thing on the desk at the Halfords Auto Centre, just around the corner from where we live. And it basically was saying about how I would maybe get a customer satisfaction survey, and then there was this graph, like little speedo thing, and it basically had the needle in five, and then talked about how only five gave a positive result. 1 to 4 gives a negative result, and. And at the top of it was customer feedback is really important to us. And it really irked me. But I'm going to write a bigger piece soon about why Net Promoter Score and all its variants are the devil incarnate when it comes to social research. But what I was thinking as you're saying there about where people are giving high scores on things, we are becoming so consciously and subconsciously primed to give fives or give tens, because there is so much that is done now, whether guerrilla actions by local teams who are being bonused, or in this case from the Halfords Auto Centre, by head office, like trying to game their own statistics. And you go, what on earth is going on here? But I think actually there's quite a lot for us to be able to, and it's not just British Reserve or anything like that. We're being, you know, regularly told you must give a top marks, otherwise it's meaningless.
Yeah, we're being browbeaten, aren't we?
Really are.
When you told your health story, it reminded me a kid's party entertainer who I had booked for my daughter's like second birthday party or something asked me to review them. And I gave them a 4-star review. And the 4 stars was because they were 15 minutes late and I had 35 kids I had to entertain while wondering if this person was going to turn up or not. And then I got an email saying, well, a 4-star review is basically going to lower our average, so I'm not going to publish it. So, yeah, same deal.
Yeah, I'd have gone back with a 1 after that. That's just dreadful. Anyway, into that maelstrom. Our guest this week, Paul, how's your week?
Yeah, it's been a good week. Well, it's the start of the week so far, but last week, gosh, busy. In between the Midlands and London, running around. We're designing and delivering workshops and then balancing my startup. Very busy week, all in all. Actually, just going back to what you were saying there about the feedback scoring mechanism, the irony of them forcing you to give a good score and how that has influenced it or biased it incorrectly, rendering the whole process worthless.
No, absolutely. I mean, I'd say there is a long incoming rant in blog form coming about NPS, but it's that whole Ben Goldacre stuff about bad science, bad medicine. This is bad social science, and it's so, so prevalent in so many places. It really triggers me. But I suppose I should just get over these things. But no,
and
I won't.
It gives people a warm glow that they're doing social science as well, doesn't it? Which is even more kind of dangerous.
I can tell you, as a practitioner, right, if there's one thing you can guarantee you don't get when you're doing social science, it's a warm glow.
Okay.
Never has a warm glow been the sensation associated with social science. Mild tedium, that's probably where we're at. Anyway, with that, we are going to be talking about design. We're going to be talking about design process. We're going to be talking about coming up with innovative new ideas. So let's crack on. We have talked about design in a number of ways over the years of this podcast being in existence, and it's a subject that we keep coming back to with, I think, good reason, because I think design is still very misunderstood. I think approaches to designing things to be better is still something that's often a rare discipline within so many organisations, which is fascinating. And Paul and I met last week for one of my infamous coffees. I don't know why they're infamous now, it makes it sound more exciting. And out of that, I thought it would be really interesting to talk to you in a bit more depth about the work that you've been doing and the processes by which you've been going through to be able to get to where you are and where you want to be. Now, let's start off. Can you just give us the little I don't know, elevator pitch for what it is you're doing? Because there is an air and an element of mystery about what you're doing, which is quite exciting, and I think we'll lean into. So what's your pitch?
So I'm the founder of a company called Enough Store, and we're designing a new grocery retail platform to solve the single-use plastic crisis in fast-moving consumer goods, more specifically grocery items.
Cool. So single-use plastic and the problem of single-use plastic, I think you'd be living under a 50-year-old ice cream container if you hadn't, you know, picked up on what was going on with single-use plastics and the terrible state of the planet as a result of that. Before we get into the kind of the business journey that you've been on, I'd be interested to find out about what is it about this thing that has meant that you've gone beyond the sticking your stuff into recycling containers and gone, I need to do something more significant about this?
Well, I guess it's always a personal connection. The journey started back in 2010. I was fortunate enough to be able to scuba dive off the coast of the Galeries in Indonesia, and 10 metres down in the sea floating around, and there's plastic around me and this fish trying to eat this plastic. And it was that whole juxtaposition of being in a really beautiful part of the world and this beautiful landscape and our collective impact, seeing this plastic floating around. And I came out of the water and I just said, what are we doing? What are we doing? And I sat pondering this issue for many years since. So it's a very personal journey. And, you know, often we talk about business driven by purpose. I don't think there's any other thing that I could see myself doing now.
What an experience. That made me feel incredibly sad. I've seen these images and you don't believe it's real, do you, until you hear a story like that?
And look, I've since gone on a journey to learn a lot more, and it just doesn't stop there. If you think we struggle to deal with single-use plastics, look at countries that are less developed. Mm-hmm. Not only are we piling on the problem in these countries, they're just not in a position to deal with the volumes. Tourist attractions like those, what do they do with their plastic? If it's not in the sea, they're burning it. Anything they do with it is toxic, and it just quite simply needs to stop. And we need to make it stop happening. And, you know, it requires a lot of work, a lot of behavioural change. And I think we can do it. I hold out hope that we can change.
I've been following the Ocean Cleanup Project, where they kind of, you know, suck vast amounts of plastic out of the sea. But then, as you say, there is the problem of processing it and doing something with it. So you're trying to address the problem at source, aren't you?
Correct. Yeah. So at the top of the waste hierarchy is prevent, and that's where we're at. We're at the top of the waste hierarchy to prevent that not just plastic, to be fair, but other materials from going into the waste systems. Just plastic is obviously the most toxic out of all of them, and probably the most difficult of materials to deal with at sorting. But as you say, there's many initiatives that are going on, and you know, it's often referred to, a wonderful analogy that I often hear is that we've basically got a bath of bath water, and it's, you know, the tap's on full blast, overflowing, and we're trying to scoop it out with a teaspoon. That's what's happening at the moment.
So the Ocean Cleanup Project is that the teaspoon that's fishing this stuff out?
Correct, yeah. Our impact is tiny in comparison to the problem. And it's just getting worse and worse and worse, and it will continue to get worse unless we collectively do something about it. And it is a behavioural shift. Let's be clear. It is a behavioural shift. You know, we've got three economies for post-use, consumer use in terms of packaging, and the linear economy, which, as it says, is we take it from the ground, we make something out of it, we use it, and then we either put it in the ground again, landfills, incinerators, or sadly our environment, as we're talking about. And then there's the recycling economy. That's the economy number two. And statistics around those, if you look at Greenpeace, are just devastating. I think 8% of what ends up in our recycling bins actually gets recycled, which means 92% doesn't. And out of that 8%, the percentages there are pathetic. So, you know, even the CEO of Keep Britain Tidy has gone on record and saying that recycling is not the answer to this problem. And then the last but not least is the circular method, which is the method at which we're working at.
It's interesting. I mean, you framed a lot of this in terms of behaviour change and the extent to which behaviours that, I mean, I'm 53 now, and I remember a lot more reuse as a child, whether it was in terms of, you know, fizzy drink bottles or milk bottles being delivered to the doorstep, and the bottles would be reused and reused and reused. And there was actually a big program of behaviour change that came as a combination of a number of factors. There's a couple of books I read last year. One was a thing called Wasteland, and then there was another which was Material World by the journalist Ed Conway. And those two books combined actually give a really interesting insight into a number of the things that were going on. One of them, which is that the rise in plastics was a conscious effort by the petrochemicals industry to work out what the hell to do with the stuff that was left over after they had created oil and diesel and petrol, because there was lots of stuff left and actually petrochemical companies needed to do something with it. And plastics was one of the big, you know, drivers behind them. But there was also a bunch of behaviour changes around the idea of litter, which is, I think, something that was covered in the Wasteland book, and about how in the 50s, there was a really big effort from the packaging industry to turn litter into a problem of consumers, not of a problem of the packaging industry. And that reframing, and that there was a number of these things going on that enabled behaviour change to happen at scale, because there was a heck of a lot of money being pumped in to get people to change their behaviours one way or another to be able to suit the needs of these various dominant industries. And, you know, materially changed how we do things and how we think about things. Do you get a sense that there is opportunity for that kind of level of investment into changing behaviour happening in the near future? Are there enough rich vested interests to be able to drive it?
It's a good question. So we're seeing some policy change that inevitably will have an impact. So, for example, extended producer responsibility is a policy that's been brought in. It's a modulated set of fees that's applied at the producer end on single-use packaging, whether that be glass or plastic. And the reporting for EPR from an ESG perspective is happening as we speak. And next year, the modulated fees will be muted to the producers. The question as to whether that will impact single-use plastic or the cost of that will be pushed down to the consumer is yet to be understood. But there's early estimates that the cost for that will be 1.8 billion. It's a good question to ask in terms of where the behavioural change sits, because the presumption might be that it sits at the consumer end, but actually it's a whole scale. It's across the spectrum.
There's a lot of guilt in the messaging out to the consumer. You know, you see these terrible images, like what you described when you were scuba diving, but as the consumer, you still need to buy food that stays fresh. And unless you really make a massive effort to kind of go to markets, and there's not many options out there to avoid it. So you've kind of like got this guilt, and yet it's very difficult to change your behaviour.
Well, I mean, for starters, anybody that knows anything in behavioural change knows that whacking people with the shitty sticks never worked in the history of behavioural change. So stop doing that, because that's not going to change behaviour.
Oh, right? Note to parenting techniques, damn.
Yeah. So, you're absolutely spot on. It is, it's everywhere. And it's rapidly become everywhere, and it's hard to avoid it. And that's part of the challenge, is avoiding it. And so, you know, we've done a significant study, and that discovery has been really fascinating, starting at the consumer end to understand the problem. And what we call the value action gap in consumers. So we all know the problem that exists, and we don't need to continue talking about the problem. We know that it's toxic. We know that the impact it's having, and we know it's not good for our future health and environmental health. And so the question is, what's the next step? And that's where we're at the moment.
So you started to explore there a bit about the discovery work that you've been doing. Let's dig into that a bit more, because it's one thing to say here is a problem. It's another thing to say here is a problem, but everybody knows that the impact of this problem won't be felt for some time to come, which is a notoriously hard place to be able to get anybody to do anything differently, because it will be 5 years, it will be 10 years. It's why it's difficult for people to give up smoking. It's why it's difficult for people to be able to give up plastic containers. Same kind of rules apply, I think. So what's been the sort of focuses, or where have been the sort of focuses that you've been putting into it, be able to understand this as a broader design problem?
So, I mean, I guess starting with the design thinking principles, I'm a big fan of, design thinking, it's been around for a while. The Design Council, I believe, came up with a double diamond model, and it was popularized by Tim Brown of IDEO. Big fan of his book, Change by Design. With that in mind, we recognize that the problem is complex, and some models or frameworks for best practices are aligned to, certainly the design thinking model is a great model to use in this instance. Obviously, being it non-linear, we've explored the problem space. In the process of exploring the problem space, we've put some proof of concepts out there to test the market, to understand how they react to those. But we were not wedded to any of them, primarily because we knew that there were more insights to come. And so our process has been to look at the consumer end, because fundamentally what's happening in our industry at the moment is we've got lots of pilots and lots of trials and reuse and refill and all the rest of it. And they're not solving the challenge. Percentage-wise, they're having low penetration. And you know, retailers, driven by profit, naturally, are not making profit from these refill propositions. And I guess, more importantly, they're not seeing the penetration, or they're not seeing the numbers of consumers. And we've identified what we believe is the reason why. And that fundamentally just sits in a very simple concept that was derived by Daniel Kahneman, which is the friction versus reward. So the unmet need of the consumer at the point of the refill process is quite complex. And asking consumers to do more than they currently do is a big ask. That's the behavioural shift that we're asking. And at the moment, the friction versus reward calculation isn't there. And so we've come up with something that we believe cracks it.
So I have lived through this as a consumer. We had one of those, you know, bring your empty bottles, fill it up in the shops on the high road. And it was fine as long as nobody was there. But as soon as it got busy, you have to queue up for ages to print your labels and weigh your containers. Then you have to queue up to fill them up with stuff. Then you have to queue up again to weigh. And then you ended up spending two or three times as much as you would in the shop next door, where you could be in and out in 2 minutes with a basket full of plastic. So it's really interesting that you have put your finger on that problem from the other perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's not uncommon to hear those things. The process of refilling in the refill stores, as you mentioned, there's a lot of steps. Bringing your container, tear the weight to the scales, dispense the amount that you need and want, apply the label, take it to the till, pay for it and walk out. And the alternative for most consumers is just to walk into your local supermarket, grab it off the shelf, chuck it in your trolley, take it to the checkout and check out. So in order for it to work for consumers, we really need to give them something more, either at the point of sale or post-purchase. And so our solution, first and foremost, is designed to solve that problem. We've fixed firmly on the how might we statement, which is a problem focused statement at the end of the first diamond in the double diamond model. And it's how might we increase consumer uptake in refill to solve the plastic, single use plastic crisis. And that was the how might we statement 2 and a bit years ago when we started. And it still is the how might we statement today. And it's very much aligned to our future vision of a world where we have less plastic floating around in our seas.
I love something that you said earlier about there are more insights still to come, because I think that is such a challenging space to be in. You know, you've got your how might we statement, you've got your problem that you're trying to solve, and there must be a massive temptation to jump on a solution that looks like it might go in the right direction. How do you keep yourself honest?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. And it comes to a point where you have done all the synthesis and analysis of data that you have at your disposal now. And you have to take a bit of a leap of faith, I think, with any startup. There comes a level of a leap of faith. But also, I think I've taken my responsibilities. So my role in this is a product owner, product manager. And I've taken my role quite seriously. And really, my role is to manage four risks: desirability, viability, feasibility, and of course the risk around value and value to all stakeholders in the value stream, not just consumers. It is complex. Don't get me wrong; it's complex. And how do you stay honest with yourself? I guess you empirically keep looking at the evidence and say, is there enough evidence in this to make that leap of faith?
So it's that balance, isn't it, between enough evidence and a leap of faith. So it's an art.
It is, and a science actually. But at the same time, there has to come a point where you say, look, we've done enough here, so that we can put something out there to market. I mean, the testing and iterating and the insights, like you say, they'll never stop. If you're a business that wants to iterate and learn and grow and develop like you should do in an agile way, then you should be willing and open to hearing those insights and have a hypothesis or multiple hypotheses to test as you go through to the next phases of your project and delivery of your platform. So the insights don't stop. We welcome them with open arms.
It's like a series of sliding door moments where you have to make a choice between do we do this or do we do that, or do we do this or do we not do anything yet. And that's hard, because that's about having to make some choices. And, you know, I know, you know, the lean startup world, everybody talks about the pivot and all the rest of it. But particularly when you are working in a realm which isn't about purely software, where pivoting in software is easy because, you know, it's not that hard to change your mind with some lines of code in comparison to, I don't know, for example, sending off a lot of money for somebody in Italy to print some playing cards, where you've got a binary decision that's been made and then there's no going back from it. Otherwise, you've got a lot of, you know, paper to pulp. I don't know who might have that experience, but, you know. It's been really interesting for me, though, actually, with the playing cards over the last few years, is actually getting involved in making physical product. I'm not doing it at a tiny scale, but there's something about going down the route of physical product that actually brings home a lot of these moments where actually there are, you know, nothing is fixed forever, but there are some decisions when it comes to the physical world which are far less irreversible than those with the software world.
It's where that question, what is the smallest next step we can take, or the least expensive next step we can take to learn something else and prove the next step and get our next valuable insight? And that becomes so much more important, I think. And we sort of play at it in agile software development, don't we? But when you're making real physical life decisions, the stakes are a bit more real feeling, I guess.
They are. However, there's so much we can do now without physically building something. So, for example, our grocery platform and solution, we've got a 3D model. So you can go into a 3D room and explore what our store will look like and experience how you'll experience it when it's built. So the next phase is really now securing the capital to grow the proposition and you know, have a what we would call a large-scale demonstrator, a physical manifestation. But we're planning our investment launch later this year, where we're planning to invite investors who have precedent for investing in impact businesses. So, and you know, will we be inviting them into a VR experience so that they can go and experience what this store will be like?
And that actually shouldn't be underestimated. The advances in our ability to be able to create realistic virtual environments, even in the last 10 years, how much that's moved forward. So I spent 3 years or so head of technology for an experiential marketing agency called Imagination, an amazingly creative organisation. I was there between 2008 and 2011. And when I started there, we still had a model shop because it was still actually preferable often to be able to have a physical scale model of something that we were proposing to a client than it was to have a 3D render, because the 3D renders weren't that good still, and they were expensive and they were really time consuming. They took, you know, shed loads of computing power to be able to create, and at the end of the day you could get your client and you could point at a thing and say, look at that there, what do you reckon, that does that work, should that angle there, or all this kind of stuff. By the time I left in 2011, they'd got rid of the model shop because that was kind of the end of that era. But now, I mean, my youngest is dabbling with the idea of wanting to become a physical product designer. He's playing around with SketchUp in a browser window and is able to create really quite impressive 3D models from scratch in software that he's running in his browser.
Absolutely. And look, there have been comments people have asked, so you know, they've asked the question, where is this? Because it's so photorealistic, it's so real life that you know, somebody actually thought I dropped a camera in this thing with a 360 degree camera and took a picture, because it is that good. By the way, going back to your son, and that's another area of my interest in product design and product development, generative AI, what that's going to do to that industry is incredible. You know, with Fusion 360, they, in the product design world, you can design just the outline of what it is you're designing, tell the system where the loads are, and then allow the computer to strip all the unnecessary material from the design. You know, how technology is going to really change that world, and, you know, generative AI is just incredible in the product design space.
Mm. So where are you at this point now, then? You've done quite a bit of research, you've collaborated with a bunch of people. Have you got interest from, or are you fighting against the big incumbents in the world of the supermarkets?
So one of my founders, one of the founders that joined the business, has come from one of the grocery retailers. And the challenges that the grocery retailers are having is that they are obviously wanting to remain profitable in a very challenging economic environment amidst, you know, margins that are so minuscule. Our concept is to work in collaboration with the grocery retailers. However, it's not absolutely essential for us to do that, in all honesty. We're looking to grow a number of these units up and down the country. How we do that fundamentally will be defined by how the MVP performs. We would like to work in collaboration with grocery retailers and offer it as a platform to, as a collaboration, much like what you would call a challenger bank inside an existing bank like NatWest, which they, does exist. We would happily offer our platform as a place for them to experiment and de-risk refill. That's really been our ambition, is to de-risk and refill for the supply chain. There's still some work that needs to be done to ascertain really how that's going to play out. Grocery retailers, we've spoken to one or two, can't really say much about that, but we've spoken to some major brands, and certainly there's a lot of interest from major brands as to what we're trying to do.
Have you defined the MVP, or are you still iterating? Yes, okay.
Yeah, physically where it's going to be is another matter. But we know what the vision is, yeah, in terms of what we're going to be delivering for the MVP. Yeah, absolutely. It's very clear.
So the next step is to...
The next step is to secure the investment to go and run the experiment. Exactly, yeah. So it would be between 6 months and a year to run the MVP pilot large-scale demonstrator. And we'd like to do it in cities like Leeds or Manchester, and have at least four of them. So what does that look like? So they're similar to the Box Park in Shoreditch format, so 40-foot shipping containers, But these are for grocery refill. These are designed predominantly for variable weights and variable volumes, goods. So similar to refill type stores. But fundamentally, our key differentiator is the technology and the experience that the customer has whilst shopping. I can't go into too much of that because that's still stuff that we'd want to keep under the radar. But ultimately, it meets that customer need of reducing the friction at the point of sale, but also increasing consumer reward. And it adds an inordinate amount of value back into the supply chain, into the value chain. And that's really been where we've been at. So at the start of the journey, you know, like most founders start off with this kind of naive perspective about, you know, we're going to change the world and this is how we're going to do it. And reality kicks in. It's like, well, no, there's a reason why single-use plastic's so pervasive in supermarkets. It's because it's cheap. As you said earlier on, Matt, it's driven by the gas and oil industries, the petrochemical companies. They're driving this cheap supply of plastic into the food supply chain. And so you have to fight against that. And in doing so, what we've diligently tried to do is ascertain where there's more value that we can supply back to the value chain in delivering this platform. In the early days, I'd spoken to some experts for them to tell me where my biggest challenges were. And they did, quite happily so. And that's been our 2-year discovery, really, is to find that additional value that we can offer back so that we can justify this platform that we're building. And we're gonna, you know, and so that's where we're at the moment. We've got there. We've got the solution. We've got it ready to go. We just need to raise the investment to make it happen.
Fascinating stuff. Paul, if people want to find out more, how might they do that?
Good question. We can check our website out, which is enough.store. At the moment, that won't take you anywhere, but in the next couple of weeks, we'll have something up there, a bit of a holding page where we can, if you'd like to sign up to our mailing list, you'd be more than welcome to, and we'll keep you abreast of everything that's going on.
I'll put a link onto the show notes as well. What have you got coming up in the week ahead?
So tomorrow, back down to London, got a workshop that I'm delivering, so a bit of planning for it, final bit of planning for it tomorrow night or tomorrow afternoon. Then running a workshop in Shoreditch on Wednesday, so that's an all-day thing. Thursday, just meetings. Like I say, it's a constant balance of pushing things forward with the startup, but also keeping the money rolling in through your consultancy work, well, through my consultancy work. So
that's a challenging balance.
It is.
Great stuff. Julia, how about you? What's your weekend looking like?
Well, so I'm heading up to Manchester on Thursday to get some face-to-face time with people, which is always nice. And the idea is they can ask me all the difficult questions about psychological safety and these conversations. And then the following week, I'm going to a client event, which I'm quite looking forward to, actually.
Yeah. That's pretty exciting. Yes, clients. Well, I'll be starting up my new client on Monday. Team gets ready for that on Thursday, which also clashes with, on Friday, a 90-minute meeting with a potential client. It never rains, it pours. So that'll be fun. And yes, other than that, I've got a new podcast idea that I'm working on in the background, which I'm quite excited about. And I am plotting, basically, but there's this idea that I've done a little pilot of, and the pilot came out really well. So I'm going to see if I can make that happen as well. Because I don't think, you know, it's enough to have one podcast this day and age. You've got to have at least two.
Your podcast empire.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see where that gets to. But that, I'll start to be able to lift the covers on that soon. Anyway, that's it for another episode. We have guests, we have hosts next week. I can't remember either of which is which, but there's definitely people lined up for it, so it's very exciting. And thank you, Paul, for joining us this week.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
A great pleasure. And we will be back next week. More guests, more talk, more interesting things, and absolutely no single-use plastic involved in this show whatsoever. See you then.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on the internet at wb40podcast.com and on all good podcasting platforms.